Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime to seek answers to questions large and small, although there don't seem to be any small ones anymore. Today, I am delighted to have here in the studio with me Peter Reinierson, who is an author, entrepreneur, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and Stephen Silla, founder of Journalism That Matters, a former reporter for the Minneapolis Star and the Christian Science Monitor. And our question today is, can journalism recover? Welcome, Peter.
Hello.
Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, Susan.
Thank you for taking the time to explore this really complicated question. I'd like to start giving our audience just a little information about what each of you have in terms of history of journalism in your back pocket. Peter?
I started as a reporter at the Seattle Times in the 70s, and at that time, journalism was very well understood. We had, as reporters, we were creating news, our editors were deciding what was presented to society, and society really didn't have much opportunity to get anything we didn't present them. Even the television stations in those days generally followed our lead, so if I wrote an article on City Hall, I was a City Hall reporter for a while, that's what you'd see on King and Como that night. But this really changed, and even before I went to the Times, I went around the country, spent quite a bit of time on the road with a fellow named Dave Horsey, who's now a political cartoonist for the Seattle Times, but has worked a bunch of places. He and I went around interviewing editors on the topic of, you know, can we get more community content into our newspapers? Is there anything we can do? And basically the editor said, no, there really isn't anything you can do. If you don't own a press, you're not going to reach the public, but you can write us a letter to the editor. And this has changed so dramatically in the intervening years. About 10 years later, I was working with Bill Gates on a book called The Road Ahead, which was his vision of the future. And he introduced me to the idea of network effects, which was an idea that an economist named Brian Arthur had popularized. And it said basically that there are some businesses which have monopoly shares without actually being monopolies. And of course, he was thinking about Windows and the fact that Windows wasn't a monopoly. But if you think about network effects, it explained a lot of things. It explained why newspapers made so much money. They owned the classified advertising business. And this is the place where the community could come and contribute its own content. And everyone in the city would know where you go to learn that content or get that content. In this case, the content was what you had to buy or sell. The phone companies had the same thing with Yellow Pages. They owned this platform where the businesses created the content and everyone went there to consume it. And phone companies made huge money on Yellow Pages, and newspapers made huge money on classified ads. And there were lots of other examples of this. But the underlying idea here was that if you were a publisher who could own the place where the community came to create and consume its own content, it would be a gold mine. And it's very hard to dislodge someone who has that position. I started thinking, when I was done with The Road Ahead, I started thinking about what would happen to the newspaper industry, which is where I spent, you know, quite a bit of time. What would happen to the newspaper industry if someone other than the newspaper industry or other than journalists began to own this place where the community would congregate? And it seemed like an existential threat to the newspaper industry. And I, at that time, was running a software company. And so for about 3 years, I actually had 17 software developers working on a technology platform that would allow newspapers to blend community and professional content.
And this was before Facebook?
Oh, yeah. This is before the word blog existed. This is 1995, 96 through 99. And newspapers would always meet with me. I mean, they would always talk about it, but no one wanted to do anything. And so in 1999, I sold that to a cable television network. And then Oprah used it at Oprah.com. And the technology got some use. But I kind of gave up on it. And today we have, you know, Facebook and Twitter and other technologies companies, Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. These are the places that people come to consume and create their own content. And importantly, also to curate content. So this function, it used to be that editors in newspapers would create content and they would also present it, decide what's important. Today, these functions have been divided, where anyone can create content and anyone's Twitter feed is basically their own publication.
So it's a community of gatekeepers.
Community gatekeepers and content creators. But importantly, there's sort of no, the tyranny that used to exist where just there were a few people that had this control, that's totally been exploded, which is very liberating. It's very empowering, but also is disorienting. Because Who do you know how to, you know, who do you trust? How do you know who to trust? So that's the world we've emerged into.
And that is the big question. Stephen Cilla, you've been involved in journalism probably almost as long as Peter. What has been your experience?
Well, they say I was born with ink in my blood because my dad was the publisher of the Minneapolis Star and Tribune. And early on, I was reporting for the Star, the evening paper. And I had the good fortune of, in one summer, being able to kind of have a career in journalism, because when people went on vacation, I took their spot. So I was on the cop beat for a couple weeks. I was the religion editor for a couple weeks. I was on various investigative teams. And one day I was sent out to cover a car crash. And I got there before the police. And I was going, wait a minute, this doesn't feel like news to me. But the editor put a photograph, he sent me and a photographer, on the front page of the paper. And I went back and I said to him, this is not news. Car crashes happen every day. And he said, well, frankly, Steve, we give the animals what they want. And I think that that attitude is what, you know, Peter was saying, when the editors of the newspapers were the gatekeepers, it was one-to-many communication. And the biggest change that we've seen now is that it's many-to-many. Anybody can be a publisher. So Journalism That Matters has tried to help both people in the news industry and people in communities take a look at what is a civic communication system? What would a healthy communication system look like in a given community?
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned that the editor was into the sensational view, essentially.
If it leads, it leads, yeah.
Yes, right, which leads me to the question of the impact of the commercial nature of journalism in this country and how that's affected the gatekeepers and the news that we actually got. How has that impacted the nature of what we call news that is useful, and our consumers getting news that they can really use? In your book, Stephen, which is, give me the title.
Oh, it was Telling Stories.
Telling Stories.
The final report of the Good News, Good Deeds Project.
You have this great chart that asks, what is an effective citizen? And it goes right down through the whole idea of being part of a community, knowing your neighbors, taking responsibility for problem solving, knowing where to get accurate information, knowing where to go and what to do to get things done, listening twice, thinking about things, discussing public issues, and thinking bigger, voting, and contributing time or money to your community. That's an effective citizen. Presumably, in a democracy, we all want to be effective citizens. But has our news media been in the habit of giving us information that allows us this sort of access?
You know, your editor who told you that he gave him what the animals wanted or whatever, he was also giving him what was really inexpensive to produce. And, of course, this is what television news does all the time. I think it's worse now, but even back in 1979 when I covered City Hall for the Seattle Times, Cairo, I remember, had 7 reporters. And they had a news helicopter. But they had 7 reporters and they're covering the city, and they would come into a city council meeting and be there for 5 minutes, and whatever they happened to capture on video is what you'd see. You know, they'd call later and ask the staff like what happened, so they'd have the headline, but whatever you saw on video would just be the 5 minutes that they were there for. So they were engaged, and a lot of journalism organizations were engaged in trying to do things very cost effectively. The problem today is that because the economic model has been destroyed, the money is now all flowing to places like Facebook and other things. Every news organization has to engage in cost-effective reporting, and that hurts society. I mean, the New York Times may be an exception because they have so many subscribers. But in general, you know, the legs have been knocked out from under the industry.
Well, and organizations like the New York Times have included electronic and radio information in their platforms. So they are maintaining their subscribership, I would guess, in part because they're providing other sorts of platforms. And I would guess that their staff budget is a lot bigger than most other news media.
Oh, sure. They're the envy of the industry, I'm sure. Wall Street Journal is a good economic model, too. If you look at something like CNN, you know, CNN for a long time was a television network, a news network, where they had reporters out doing it was expensive to send people out to report the news. They don't do that at all anymore. I mean, I happen to watch some of these cable shows fairly often in the age of Trump, but it's all like, what did the New York Times say? What did the Washington Post say? And they get some people to come in and talk about it. And that's all they program. It is really inexpensive to bring people in and have them talk about the news. And so we see this across the entire ecosystem of news. There's the economic model is being destroyed. It's just been, you know, been burned to the ground.
Could that be a good thing?
Well, I think so. In the sense that it makes the industry have to rethink itself. And one of the things that's come out of journalism that matters is the idea of a sixth W, beyond who, what, where, when, why. When you're telling a story, what if you ask the question, what's possible now? So it puts the reporter in a position that some might say is not the right position if a reporter's just holding up a mirror to society. But if you're asking the question, what's possible now, you're asking your subjects to think about the future. And it puts the reporter in more of a potential futurist position, which I think would help journalism.
That kind of flies in the face of supposed objectivity, which personally I believe is impossible. You're kind of saying to the reader or the listener or the viewer, what's next? And then you're positing a possibility.
No, I'm asking them to. I'm asking.
Okay.
As a reporter, I'm not positing myself, but I'm asking my subjects, the people who are involved in the, say, the community council on Vashon, what is possible now? If that became part of the journalist's role, I think it would help engage the public more. And likewise, journalism that matters has become kind of a petri dish for engaged journalism. And we've come up with these principles that we think engaged journalism would have. One of them is nothing about us without us. People telling their own stories as part of the storytelling. It's not just the reporter, but the real words of the people whose story is being told. The second one is listening is our superpower. Imagine if the media had really listened in the 2016 election run-up. I think the coverage would have been different than it was. And the third one is speak truth to empower. Traditionally, journalists have looked at their role as speaking truth to power. But what if you're speaking truth to empower citizens to be more effective? So those are kind of the things that have emerged in the years of journalism that matters. As the future, you know, better journalism would happen if these principles were followed.
But how do you afford that?
What's the economic model for journalism that matters?
Seems, if you think about one thing you learn in the software industry is that you can envision whatever kind of future you want. You can have lots of good ideas, but in the end, the market tells you what it wants. And so a lot of leadership, I would say Bill Gates, a lot of times it wasn't that he was inventing the future so much as he was foreseeing where we were heading, and he just got Microsoft out there doing that particular kind of thing. So when you think about how to conduct journalism better, it's all tied into the economics of it. What can we afford to do? And then some of these great principles you have with JTM, with Journalism That Matters, those may prove out in the marketplace or they may not, but without an economic model to support the industry, how do you even have the experiment?
Well, there are organizations like National Public Radio that survive on contributions, presumably. They also have corporate and foundation support. What do you think is the potential for the survival and the veracity of organizations like that? In other words, how long can we expect organizations like National Public Radio and Public TV to remain clean?
Well, of course, a lot of people say they aren't. I'm a great admirer, but a lot of people, especially on the right, would say they're not clean.
Yeah, right. Well, and yeah. Let's talk about the right.
You know, if going back to the question, though, if you're talking about NPR's business model or the local station's business models, it's a combination of subscriptions. It's voluntary subscriptions,
yes.
But it's a combination of subscriptions and advertising, which are the corporate sponsorships. Right. They kind of dress it up in a pretty way, but it comes back to those things. The third form of revenue that that's happening with media organizations is transactional commerce kind of revenue. So even on the New York Times, if they review a book, you know, if you click on it, you buy it through Amazon, they will acknowledge they get an affiliate payment from Amazon for directing the traffic their way.
Oh.
And so, you know, increasingly, and certainly Facebook and those sort of alternatives to traditional news outlets do that kind of thing. So that is another way that, you know, creative journalist organizations are trying to figure out how to survive and basically provide services. If you think about things like Atlantic, you know, they host conferences. And that's another way to think about journalism is journalists have been in the community business. They've been in the business of bringing people together. And in the days before interactivity, if you wanted to know about farming and wanted to talk to farmers, if the farmers weren't around you, what you could do is get a farming magazine. It was a way for you to interact with the community, or you could read National Geographic if you cared about certain kinds of topics. Today, that's all been exploded, and it's all interactive, and there's other ways for people to engage in communities. But publications that are trying to support good journalism often do other kinds of things to host community events. And so The New Yorker does a lot of this. The Atlantic does this. The Vail conferences and Aspen conferences, these things, they all get tied together where people try to figure out some way to profit off their community connections.
Doesn't the Washington Post make a lot of income on its educational testing company? Do they still have that?
I think that was divested. That was sort of a controversial business.
A while it was keeping them afloat.
Yeah, that was in the Graham days, not the Bezos days.
Well, so these somewhat diversified media become central points of information for niche markets, which is what they were doing before. And so some of them are surviving by diversifying their income. And that makes me think about local newspapers. Some of what I've read has said that local newspapers are doing better than national newspaper because of their community focus and their support from the community.
I think that's true. And look at Vashon's media ecology. We're fortunate to have both the Beachcomber and the Loop and Voice of Vashon radio and TV. We've got a better media atmosphere, I think, than many other small communities that are media deserts.
Well, and I'd like to make my plug for community radio simply because there's so much corporate media out there now that is homogenized, if you will, to the lowest common denominator. Things like Voice of Vashon are the only independent, truly owned by the community media outlets that are still alive. Unfortunately, we don't have a gigantic signal, but we do have the web.
Yeah, and you reach the island, certainly.
Yes, we reach the island.
Yeah, the Voice of Vashon is a work of passion by a bunch of talented people. Not every community has that. I mean, it's the demographics of the island, the professional people that are here, the fact that people are a little bit older on average, so you have more people who have more time available and yet have the expertise. But that's not transferable to every community.
No, it's not. And it makes me take us back again to the idea of Facebook and social media, which might also be considered works of passion. And how do we navigate passion over truth?
But I'm not, there is passion there, but I think in the case of Facebook, it's economic passion. I mean, if you look at Facebook's decision, if you look at the decisions that Zuckerberg makes, they're almost always the decision that leads to Facebook making more money. And so I don't think of it as being a noble pursuit. I think what Voice of Vashon is doing is a noble pursuit, but I don't think what Facebook's doing is a noble pursuit. I mean, why do they not want to vet political ads? Well, it's expensive to do that. They make more money. Plus, they might have to turn away some revenue if they vetted their ads. So if you look at their decisions, it's almost always the thing that makes them the most money. So I'm not sure it's a work of passion. They may work passionately at it. They may be software developers who are passionate about their work, but I don't think it's a noble work of passion.
So the organization isn't necessarily working on passion. The people who use it might be working on
passion.
Well,
it's not passion for humanity. It's not passion for building a better society.
Right. Right.
It's a very self-interested passion, as is Fox News, I might add.
And they're both potentially dangerous in impacting people with fake news and alternative facts.
Yeah, let's go to, you mentioned the right earlier, Peter, and our president recently awarded Rush Limbaugh the Medal of Honor. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I mean, there aren't many fans of any of that on Vashon. There are a few. I'm not among them. I'm not sure I have anything notable to say about it, except that there's no previous president that would have done that. However, there's also no previous president who would have governed by tweet.
By tweet.
Either. You know, and again, that's possible because he has a way to reach the world in a disintermediated way. He no longer makes a press statement, which NBC News reports. He can now just blast it out to tens of millions of people. So it, the ecosystem is very different.
And that brings me to the question of the role of government in journalism these days. Our current administration is calling news reporters, professional news reporters, the enemies of the people. What impact does that have on the potential for quality journalism surviving and getting out to people versus the word of the government or of any other Yahoo who wants to say something?
You know, that's what autocrats say.
Yeah.
Lots of autocrats have said it, and it can be effective, especially when you don't have a strong independent media and so or news organizations. So that's what is, in terms of the existential crisis for America, which I think a lot of us feel is happening, one big factor of that is the fact that the news media is, with its economic legs knocked out from under it, its capacity to play the watchdog and to be a strong voice versus, say, Donald Trump's is pretty limited. And so it's scary.
It's really been hindered. And to question the value of the press, which, you know, is enshrined in the Constitution as one of our the Fourth Estate, kind of undermines people's ability to. I guess one of the things that we've been dealing with a lot is media literacy. How does somebody decide what's good? What, like, I tend to watch PBS NewsHour, and I pretty much don't, except maybe NPR, don't listen to any other media, except I like to go to Fox News and MSNBC just to see what the what the different pundits are saying. But how do you find out who you trust? And that's a big question. I talk to kids in community college, and they say they get their news from Instagram, from their friends. So, okay, who are the trusted people? And what are some of the new roles in media? The whole idea of the information architect, how do we design platforms like you've done, Peter, that make it easy for people to get good information?
Yeah, you know, one thing I did that was not successful, I've done four startups and three were successful, one was not successful. It was called Intersect. It was an attempt to compete with Facebook. And the idea was that you could go and find all the stories, all the postings that happened at a given time and place. You could say, at the Vashon High School game at 7:30 on Saturday night or 8 o'clock on Saturday night, you could go there and find all the photos and postings and other things that people had done at that. You wouldn't have to know anyone to see their photos. All you'd have to know is where it happened or what happened on the ferry boat today. That was technically successful. It worked, but it got no market share because Facebook had sort of sucked all the oxygen out of the room.
Exactly. But, I tried it. I liked it.
I thought it was
promising platform, but not enough people were there.
Yeah, you just couldn't. It was a network. It was up against a network effects business, and good luck. But you know, that's an interesting. I've thought about that. What if that had succeeded? What if that had succeeded? You know, today, and I was running it still. Who knows? But if that were true, how would I be dealing with these issues? Because then you'd have this platform where people would be contributing information and misinformation, and God knows it's be a very hard challenge.
How do you confirm the veracity of what you're consuming on media? There are conspiracy theories that say the government and or the right has worked hard at making the truth a question mark so that we don't know who to believe. How do you respond to that notion?
Seems true. I mean, Trump's repetition, it's a perfect call. It was a perfect call. You know, people buy into that.
Mm-hmm. And it's good to question authority, you know? He kind of won on that whole premise, and he's a one-note pony.
So back to our question today, which is, can journalism recover?
Mm.
Stephen, you mentioned that younger folks, who we hope will vote, are consuming their news and information via Facebook and Instagram. I'm sure there are a whole lot of other folks out there. I might call them lazy consumers, but the other thing is they are torn in so many different directions, not the least of which is how to make enough money to put food on the table. So What would you advise people to do to get information that truly is useful in their lives? That car crash doesn't make any difference to me, but what our legislators are doing really does affect my life. How do I get people to consume that kind of news? How do I get that kind of news to them? And how do I advise them to consume
it? Is that a
it?
Question aimed at consumers or aimed at society? If you're a consumer, the answer is subscribe to things. You know, subscribe to the subscribe to the Beachcomber, to the New York Times, the Washington Post, et cetera. You know, the New Yorker. You know, subscribe to
Atlantic.
Those organizations. Vote with your, the Atlantic. Vote with, and I subscribe to almost all of those, not every one of them. But, you know, vote with your money. That's what you can do as a consumer. As to what society can do, I don't know. I mean, nor does anyone else, or there'd be a solution.
Yes,
I mean,
right.
For 10 or 15 years now, the media industry has been running around saying, what the hell are we going to do? And there is no answer. Yet.
Well, there are a lot of experiments, and a lot of those experiments have failed. One of them came out of Journalism That Mattered. It was called Spot.us, and it was crowdfunded journalism. So if a journalist had a story that they wanted to do, there was one that Investigate West did about the cruise ship industry in Seattle and how it was affecting Puget Sound pollution-wise. And they funded that through Spot.us, where people said, yeah, I want to pay a journalist to do that story. So that's one model. But
how much was raised?
I think they raised about $2,000 or $3,000.
So that was a few weeks of a journalist time.
That was a one-shot
deal. Yeah. And Spot.us didn't succeed ultimately. It was bought by Minnesota Public Radio, and then they let it go. Other experiments like the Seattle Globalist came out of Journalism That Matters, a bunch of young journalists who started this great news organization.
We have 1 minute
it's
left.
It's gone under.
We have 1 minute left.
So
Voice of Vashon won't allow me to go on forever and ever, much as we would like to.
But this is a case of where you experiment and you try lots of things, and it's evolution. Almost all are going to fail. Some are going to try. The failures are going to cost people money, and it'll cost grief, but that's the way we move forward.
Test, test, test. Yes,
I
want to
thank
you.
It's true in the auto industry.
Yes.
True in the communications
yes,
industry.
Yes, it is. I want to thank you both so very much for your wisdom and your insights. Thank you, Stephen Silla. Thank you, Peter Reinierson. And thank you, listener, for joining me here on Real Talk. We're here every Tuesday at lunchtime or on voiceofvashon.org/realtalk at your convenience. Thanks for listening.